momentum tensor. Remember, the philosophy is still the following. We assume that, anyway, does it help to have the amplification in the room, the sound amplification? You didn't even know it? Okay. All right, so let's leave it on then. So the philosophy is still that we assume spacetime to be a fixed given background curved Tudor-Romani manifold. We are not yet looking at the dynamics of the spacetime itself. Instead, we assume that the spacetime is given. And then we ask, first of all, how do fields that live on that spacetime behave? Then we ask, what is the energy momentum tensor of those fields? And we found that the energy momentum tensor expresses energy and momentum all right, but generally they are not conserved. And then we looked at cases where energy or momentum are conserved, the instances of Killing vector field. And we will continue with this today, wrap up the business of the energy momentum tensor, and then ask, what is the dynamics of spacetime itself? So we'll continue with the energy momentum tensor for now. Remember how we define the energy momentum tensor. The energy momentum tensor describes the reaction of the action. I shouldn't say reaction yet. It describes how the action changes if we change the shape of the manifold. If you play around with the shape of the manifold, we deform it a little bit. What does the action do? That's exactly what the energy momentum tensor tells us. So if we allow the manifold to change a little bit, parameterized by a parameter lambda, if lambda is equal to zero, we haven't changed the shape of the manifold. If lambda is non-zero, it is a little bit changed locally. So if we do a local change of the manifold, then the action will change a little bit. And by how much it will change, I mean, the rate of change with the change of lambda is given by an expression like this. It's obviously proportional to the variation in the metric. And it's an integral over the variation in the metric. We choose to write the square root of g in here so that this becomes, as usual, a volume form. I don't know where this black spot over here comes from. Let's just get rid of this. And then this proportionality constant, or not really a constant, the proportionality tensor that we need in order to make this equation right is called the energy momentum tensor. Let me remind you that the energy momentum tensor, according to this definition, would not in principle need to be symmetric. Because if it had an anti-symmetric part to it, it wouldn't change the overall outcome of this integral. Because the anti-symmetric part, being contracted with the symmetric part of the metric, would drop out. So it is a definition that the team you knew is a symmetric tensor. This is the detailed definition for what we really mean when we write in a shorthand notation that team you knew is up to a prefactor of 2 over square root of g, the functional derivative, or the variational derivative of the action with respect to a change in the metric. So we will, in the future, usually write this when we mean that. And when, in particular, we mean that team mu is a symmetric part of that. We found that the so-defined energy momentum tensor always has this property that if we calculate the covariant derivative, which is in the new direction, and then contract the new indices, this is always zero. And we say that it is covariantly conserved. You might call it like that. But it doesn't mean that we have a conservation law. Remember that what this equation expresses is not a symmetry in the physics. It expresses a symmetry in the mathematics only. It expresses simply that the mathematics is entirely invariant under diffeomorphisms, which is to say that it is the same. The outcome of all calculations is the same, no matter which coordinate systems we choose. And that, of course, cannot have physical significance, whereas conservation laws really have physical significance. So how come that this is not a conservation law? See, remember that if we have an equation k mu semicolon mu contracted equal to zero, that does lead to conservation law. But here we have an extra index, the mu, and this is screwing it up. Remember how that works? If you have k mu semicolon mu is equal to zero, well, then k mu semicolon mu square root of g is a divergence, okay? And a divergence is always the exterior derivative after an inner derivative of the volume form. And the key issue is that you have an exterior derivative with which it starts. And that means that by Stokes' theorem, you can turn a volume integral into a surface integral. And that is what gives you a conservation law. But if you have an extra component there, then it's not true that if you multiply this thing with square root of g, you get a volume form. No, it has to be just a one tensor, not a two tensor. However, we can help it. We can basically overcome that problem here in special circumstances, and that was the circumstance of Killing vector field. Namely, if spacetime possesses isometries, which is to say it possesses covariant so-called Killing vector fields psi that obey this condition here. Remember what that is. The Lie derivative of the metric is zero, is a non-trivial condition, whereas the covariant derivative of the metric equals zero is always obeyed in general relativity because it's a consistency condition between the affine connection and the metric. So if we have the non-trivial condition that the Lie derivative of the metric is equal to zero is obeyed, then psi is a Killing vector field. Remember what the Lie derivative of g is. It starts out with the covariant derivative of g, which is vanishing, and then we have two extra terms. And the sum of the two has to be zero. So that is what this equation is. It's a set of differential equations for those vector fields psi. Now, if that holds true, then let me quickly remind you how that works. If we have a Killing vector field, then we can contract it with the t mu mu to obtain a contravariant vector field p mu. And p mu then obeys this equation, which we said thus leads to a conservation law, simply because we get a volume form, divergence. And that is exterior derivative after inner derivative of the volume form. The exterior derivative we can get rid of at the cost that we get a boundary operator over here. And that is a conservation law. We can integrate out that equation to get that equation. OK, so that so far just review. Now, a proposition. How many Killing vector fields can a spacetime maximally have? The answer depends on the number of dimensions of the spacetime. If, as is likely, our spacetime has 3 + 1 dimensions, that number is 10, as we will later see. Maximally, spacetime could have 10 Killing vector fields, 10 independent Killing vector fields that are not linear combinations of another, but each of them obeys the Killing vector equation. In reality, actual spacetime, as we see it, certainly has no Killing vector field. However, it is often a convenient and not so bad approximation to assume that spacetime, at least locally, and perhaps even globally, has some Killing vector fields. Sometimes we are not so interested in tiny details that may spoil it. And then we can assume the existence of feeling vector fields, and that will simplify things dramatically because we can integrate out certain things. We will later do that in practice, and we will later do a detailed classification of what those vector fields can be. Especially for cosmological models. They can be categorized with respect to the killing vector fields that they have. Now, there are two kinds of killing vector fields that I'd like to talk about already because they are of significance more widely than just cosmology, and this seems to be a natural place to just put a little bit of meat to it, to this business of killing vector fields. So a space-time is what is called stationary, and that's different from static, which is a definition that we will get next. A space-time is called stationary if it possesses a time-like killing vector field, which is to say that it possesses a killing vector field psi, which also obeys the condition that it is everywhere time-like. Remember from special relativity that with respect to our sign convention in the metric, where you have a negative sign in front of the temporal component, we have that the length of all of those killing vectors everywhere in the manifold is negative. If it were zero, we would say that it is a null killing vector field, and if it were positive, we would say it's a space-like vector field. So a space-time is called stationary if it has the killing vector field that is everywhere time-like. Concretely, the killing vector field equation is this, and the condition that the killing vector field is also time-like is that, of course. Now, why would it be that we call such space-times stationary? Well, we call them stationary because what the existence of such a killing vector field means is that if you travel along the integral curve of such a time-like killing vector field, then you will see, I don't know, this seems to be changing quicker than usual, then you will see no change in the prevailing local curvature. And the point is that since psi is time-like, you can actually travel along the integral curve of the vector field. You see, if you have a generic killing vector field, which may not be time-like everywhere, then you will have a flow. But if the flow is not time-like, you cannot travel it. All velocities of all objects always have to be time-like. If they were space-like, you would be traveling faster than the speed of light. So having a time-like vector field allows you to actually travel along that flow. And we know that if you travel along the flow and the killing vector field condition is obeyed, then you see that the metric is not changing. So that means that if you travel along that flow and you use a coordinate system that goes along with that flow, then you find that the metric for you is not changing, actually. Now, that's a very nice condition. However, it is not, there is a subtle variation to it. You see, if you have a time-like killing vector field, then while it does imply that the metric in a suitable coordinate system does not change along the flow induced by the killing vector field, this does not mean that the metric actually takes this nice form. Now, why would that be a nice form? See, if the metric looks like that, and I'm thinking of, you know, a global piece, I mean, a larger piece of the manifold, where you travel along your flow on the manifold, then if you have an adapted coordinate system, a so-called co-moving coordinate system, then the metric will look like that, not just in a point, but in that whole patch, right? I mean, in a point, we can always make it look like minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, and zeros everywhere. But this is something we would like to have in a whole patch. If we can achieve this, then the key benefit is that we have cleanly separated space from time. Because in all the equations of motion, there will be time derivatives, and there will be space derivatives, but no mixture. There won't be cases where we have d by dxt, d by dxt and d by dx. X is mixing. So that's very nice, because that will be a purely elliptic. This leads to elliptic operators, like Laplace operators, with very nice functional analytic properties. We know how to solve that sort of problem. And then time can be considered completely separately. But stationarity doesn't imply that. We need an extra condition to assure that this is the case, that the metric takes this form. And if the metric does take that form, then the space-time can take that form in suitable coordinates, then that space-time is what is called static. So if a space-time obeys that condition above, then it's called static. But the original definition is that a space-time is called static if its Skinning vector field, which you can, it's a covariant vector, therefore it is a one form. If you view its Skinning vector field as a one form, it obeys this Frobenius condition. It turns out, we're not going to prove this in detail, but it turns out that this condition is equivalent to the condition that the metric in a suitable coordinate system takes this form. And I just want to point out that, to make this plausible, that if you take the Killing vector field and calculate that three form, remember this is a one form, that's a two form, the wedge product is a three form, we calculate that wedge product, that it will be coming out trivially zero if the metric can be written in this form. So one direction is pretty simple. If you know that the metric looks like that, then you know that your Killing vector field, having to be time-like, takes a very simple form, and you can assume it to be just non-zero over there in this corner. And then you can easily verify that this tree form will have to vanish. It's slightly more non-trivial to check that if that condition holds, you can actually always write the metric in this way. But we will not spend time on that. Okay, so we have now looked at special cases. We said that generically the energy momentum tensor expresses the change of the action when you change the shape of the manifold. Okay, that's how we define it. And then we said, well, the energy momentum tensor has this covariant conservation law, which is not really a conservation of anything. It's just a Bianchi identity. It just expresses diffeomorphism invariant. And then we said, okay, but if there are Killing vector fields, then we have conservation laws. There are no Killing vector fields in nature, but through good approximation, we may have Killing vector fields, and that gives us, through good approximation, some conservation laws that may be very useful. But it's but really there are no Killing vector fields, of course, in nature. Now, a further consideration that is very important with the energy momentum tensor is what can we say about the energy momentum tensor? Or what should we assume about the energy momentum tensor without really calculating it in detail? See, in practice, it's enormously difficult to calculate the energy momentum tensor. And that's because we have a huge number of fields that go into its calculation. Everything enters into the energy momentum tensor. The electromagnetic fields, intraton fields, Higgs fields, strong, weak interaction, every little particle that is around, even particles that we haven't discovered yet, they all contribute to the energy momentum tensor. So since the energy momentum tensor is going to feature very prominently in the Einstein equation, it would seem from that point of view that we will have to postpone any attempt at solving the Einstein equation until we know what the energy momentum tensor is, which is to say until we know what fields there are in nature. And it's not likely that we know that anytime soon, exactly which fields there exist in principle. See, the point is that even fields of particles that we haven't discovered yet will contribute to the energy momentum tensor significantly because they contribute to the vacuum energy. So therefore, it is important, we will find it important in later investigations of general relativity, to consider general assumptions that we may be able to make about properties of the energy momentum tensor. Assumptions of the kind, I don't care what exactly the field content is. I believe that anyway, the outcome will be, when I calculate the energy momentum tensor, that the energy momentum tensor has such and such properties. And there are two such assumptions, and we will get several more later on, that stand out. One is the weak energy condition. And the weak energy condition, I'm calling it condition because that's how you will find it in the literature. But really, it's an educated guess. It's an assumption. It's an assumption that if we knew all fields that exist in nature and then explicitly calculated the energy momentum tensor, we would find the energy momentum tensor to have such and such property. That's the status of it. So the weak energy condition is as follows. The idea, the assumption is, and I will call it what it is, an assumption. The assumption is that P mu nu contracted with V mu V mu is larger than zero for all time-like vector fields V, which, time-like, meaning that, their length is negative. Why would we assume that? Well, remember that observers travel causally with less than the speed of light. So any velocity you may travel with is, as a time-like, a vector field. Then when you calculate V mu, V mu, T mu nu, you're projecting, in essence, to the zero, zero component. I mean, if you were sitting at rest, then your velocity is only in the zero component and the space component are zero. You're traveling only in time, not in space. So that this thing is simply the T zero, zero component, which is, in effect, the energy. And if you look at that in some arbitrary coordinate system, then you have to write it covariantly like that. So this is the energy density. This expression here is the energy density that somebody traveling along a curve with tangent V is seeing. And this condition simply says that it's positive. So this is to say that the energy is always positive as seen by an observer. The local energy density is always positive as seen by any possible observer.
What does it mean with this condition?
Well, later on, we will see. Yes. Those conditions will be useful for two purposes here. One is, I should have mentioned that I scrolled down too quickly. First, for the occurrence of singularities. Space-time can curve so much that it develops singularities. And the evolution of space-time is driven by energy and momentum. So in order to find out whether space-time really collapses and forms singularities, we need to make some assumptions about energy and momentum. In detail, we cannot calculate what energy and momentum are doing. But we can sometimes prove that the singularities will form on the basis on some rather weak assumptions about what the energy momentum tensor can do. And that's one of those assumptions here. So later on, when we will try to prove that space-time can or must develop singularities under certain circumstances, we will appeal to the energy momentum tensor and say, well, we don't know exactly what it's doing, but as long as, let's say, the weak energy condition is obeyed, this forces us to conclude such and such. Right. And then another point is the general stability of the theory. You see, general relativity, and that's very much related to singularities, is a stable theory, whereas Newton's theory of gravity is not. think about it this way. Remember that the hydrogen atom wouldn't be stable according to classical physics. And that's because an electron would be orbiting the proton. As it does, it is a moving charge, therefore an accelerated charge. And accelerated charges act like antennas, and therefore they radiate off electromagnetic fields, right? I mean, they have a rotating electron would create changing electromagnetic fields, and they would propagate away. They would carry away energy, and therefore the electron would have to inspire, and eventually the whole hydrogen atom would have to collapse. The electron would have to clash with the proton eventually, right? And if the proton was point-like, you can actually do this. You know, could have, you know, some point-like positive particle, like an anti-muon or something like that, that doesn't annihilate with an electron, like an anti-electron as a positron would do, and then you would have an infinite infor. You would have classically that the electron that's orbiting, let's say, an anti-muon, would get closer and closer to the muon while radiating off more and more energy. Without end. Without end. It would just never end, right? And that means it's an instability of the theory. You would have a little thing that puts out energy without end. It wouldn't violate energy conservation because the electron would go deeper and deeper into the potential well, negative energy, while positive energy is thrown out. It's just an instability of the theory, right? And we know that in this case, it's the uncertainty principle of quantum theory that saves the day. Because it is because of the uncertainty principle that the electron cannot inspiral indefinitely. Because if its position was localized to a certain minimum distance, then its momentum would have to be so uncertain that its momentum is so large that it can escape the nucleus again. And that is the Bohr radius. This is the lowest stable orbit of the electron about the nucleus. It's when the uncertainty principle kicks in and says that, wait, any closer, and the electron would have enough momentum to escape further away again. So ultimately, it's quantum theory that is stabilizing classical electromagnetism. But then think about it. Gravity is just like electromagnetism in that respect. Because if you have two masses that orbit another, then they too will create changing gravitational fields, which will lead to the radiation off of gravitational fields, and that will lead to the inspiraling of the two gravitating masses. So even if you had two elementary particles that had no charges, they would be gravitationally bound, and the same collapse would happen classically. But in this case, in the case of gravity, you don't even have to appeal to quantum theory. In the case of gravity, the thing would come to an end because eventually the two gravitating masses would be close enough that they are inside their mutual Schwarzschild radius and would form a black hole. And once that's formed, it's stable. It's not going to collapse any further and radiate off more energy. So it's quite amazing, I think, that you know one of the key things that quantum theory achieves is to stabilize physics against collapse and harmonic collapse. And apparently, the same is true for general relativity. It stabilizes things. Classical physics would have been unstable for those two reasons. Gravity and electromagnetism wouldn't be stable theory. Now, in order to see that this is really so, that general relativity is really a stable theory, I just indicated it with the black hole and then that's it. You really have to prove that black holes really form. Right? I mean, you could imagine, for example, a situation where you have inspiraling mass, and it condenses, it becomes denser and denser and denser, but it never forms a black hole because you always have this tidal force. You always have this centripetal force from the rotation. You could imagine something like this. It's very complicated to actually calculate the gravitational collapse of masses that don't have high symmetry. In order to still be able to conclude that the black hole will form and stability will prevail, you have to make some assumptions, general assumptions about what energy momentum can do. You know, the energy momentum tensor is what drives the dynamics of space-time, as you will soon see. So you have to make some assumptions about the energy momentum tensor, and that's where those assumptions come in. Where I should say that they are not unchallenged. You will see. They're motivated mostly from classical considerations, but there are quantum considerations that challenge conditions like that. Okay, so we can
stability of two gravitating bodies.
Well, that's right. That could happen. Yeah, but I mean, I have to refer for the details to a little later when you actually, and then you will see how they all enter those conditions. Those conditions also enter for studies of causality. You know, can it happen that your space-time has closed time-like loops and so on, as we will see later. Okay, now the dominant energy condition. There's also a strong energy condition, but that's a different story. We'll do that later. Now, there's also the dominant energy condition, really an assumption, right? So the dominant energy assumption is the assumption that not only is the local energy density positive for all time like V, which is to say for all physical observers that travel with the velocity V, and that's true for all velocities, but also we want that K mu, which is the what we may call the projection of P mu nu in the direction of travel, is timelike. Now, what is P mu nu in the direction of travel, so projected, contracted with the velocity, with the four velocity vector? Well, it's basically the energy flow. And what we want is, and that's expressed in the dominant energy condition, is that the local energy momentum flow vector, K, this thing here, is timelike or null. So it is allowed to be null or timelike, but not spacelike. And you see, that's plausible because this, the energy momentum flow, is a flow. It's a flow of energy, it's a flow of momentum. And as such, it better be flowing causally. If it is flowing causally, it means it is flowing with at most the speed of light. It's flowing with less than the speed of light, which means its length is smaller than zero, or it is flowing with the speed of light, which is also okay. It could be just radiation, and that would be the equality sign. So therefore, one often wants not only the weak, one often wants to assume not only the weak energy condition, but also assume the dominant energy condition. Now, why is it called dominant energy condition? Well, it's called that because it expresses that energy, in some sense, dominates over momentum. Namely, if you write out this condition in an orthonormal basis, then you find that the condition reads like that, where this is the energy, the zero-zero component is larger than any one of the space-based components. So this, however, is an assumption, a condition that is motivated by fluid mechanics analogy, and quantum fields need not behave like fluids. And we saw that as far as energy and momentum is concerned, they often behave very similarly, but quantum fields really can do whatever the hell they like. So it's not obvious that this is true. And there are some concerns that, for example, the Casimir effect might violate such conditions. But I don't think that in the case of the Casimir effect, this is the case. So I think they're pretty safe, those conditions. But you know, until we really know what fields are out there, we can't really be absolutely sure. OK, so what we've done so far is looked at great detail into properties of the energy momentum tensor. Now, that was a consideration where we assumed the space-time to have some fixed background shape. What about the dynamics of space-time? How do we find out what shape it should have? There has to be an interplay between the energy momentum, between the fields that live on the space-time, and the curvature of that space-time. You all have this picture in mind where the sun, for example, is significantly curving the space around it. So there is some interaction between matter fields and the background space-time. How to describe it? Wait, is it really, is it very warm in this room? I feel pretty warm. Strange. Okay. Let's see. How do we motivate the dynamics of space-time itself? So this gets us to the Einstein equations, of course. So this, and consider the full matter action. Okay, this is what it is. The action for all the matter fields and radiation, everything. It depends on the matter fields psi, but it also depends on the metric. So we could think that maybe this is already the complete story. We have an action there, it depends on the matter field, it depends on the metric. And all we have to do is to get the equations of motion of the matter field is to functionally differentiate the action with respect to the matter field, set it equal to zero, get the Euler Lagrange equations, and there we go. These are the equations of motion of matter. And then we simply take the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric, set it equal to zero, and get the equations of motion for spacetime, for the metric. Well, it's not that easy. If we did that, if we simply assumed that this is all there is, this is the only action there is, then we don't seem to get general relativity. Because what happens if we functionally differentiate the action with respect to the metric? What sort of equation of motion do we get? You know, if we differentiate it with respect to the field psi, we get the correct equations of motion of the matter field. But if we differentiate with respect to g, do we get the correct equations of motion for the metric? Well, what we get is that this equation translates into the energy momentum tensor being zero. That can't be right. Energy momentum tensor equals zero cannot be the equation of motion for the metric. It would just simply express, well, no energy, no momentum. That can't be right. Okay, so the real story is, of course, that Einstein took a really good guess at what the action for the metric should be. So he said, well, there has to be an extra term in the action, and he made a really good guess for it. But it was a guess, and I will later show you by what he was guided in making the right guess. But I think the modern point of view should be that it can be derived in a way. In other words, if Einstein had never lived, then still general relativity would have been discovered by the following consideration, which is due to Andrei Sakharov in 1968. And he said, well, let's assume we allow spacetime to be a curved manifold. Then what dynamics would that manifold have? And the answer is, it's unavoidable that it has the Einstein dynamic because of quantum theory. So what I'll show you now has, it relates to quantum theory, especially to quantum field theory. If you have not taken that, that's a real possibility, then I hope that at least it's entertaining for you. And it's not examinable or anything, right? So but I think it's very important how to derive general relativity from quantum field theory. So we'll do that now. So Andrei Sakharov's message was, in this paper of 1968, that quantum effects of matter, of the matter fields, will induce suitable terms in the action. Will induce extra terms in the action, one of which is the Einstein term. And the other terms don't matter for reasons that I will explain in a moment. So Sakharov's reasoning was the classical deterministic evolution of matter is governed by setting the functional derivative of the action with respect to the fields equal to zero. But this is the classical theory. And according to the classical theory, we would be stuck here. We would have to take a guess at what the Einstein action is for gravity. But quantum theory goes further. Quantum theory says that, in fact, every evolution of the matter fields can occur. Not just those, not just that evolution that is consistent with the classical equations of motion. But no, every evolution, every psi I of x and t can happen virtually. Any one of those evolutions has a probability amplitude to occur. And the probability amplitude for any such evolution is given by, up to a proportionality factor, which happens to be infinite, but let's not worry about that for a moment. It's up to a proportionality constant. It is e to the power of I times the action for that field evolution. Yes.
Yes, the friend. It turns out that when you make that assumption,
then the most likely path that you will see occur actually are the paths that are, or the, not paths, but field evolution, are those field evolutions that are close to satisfying this equation. And that has to do with the fact that you have to do an integral over all possible evolutions, each one having that probability amplitude, and that integral has a settle point where the action has a vanishing derivative. And therefore, what contributes most to the integration over all possibilities are those configurations for which ds by d psi is equal to zero. Now, when you calculate that, when you calculate the quantum evolution, therefore, which is a very tedious, in practice, impossible thing to do, then at the end of the day, you can calculate what is called the effective action, which is just like the regular classical action, but it contains extra terms. And those extra terms describe the change in the equations of motion that is due to the presence of quantum effects. For example, you may remember from quantum mechanics that there's the Ehrenfest theorem, which says that for certain Hamiltonians, the expectation values of position and momentum obey the classical equations of motion, even though it's the quantum expectation value. But this actually applies only to Hamiltonians that are at most quadratic in Q and P. So for harmonic oscillators, essentially, and that's it. For any other fields, no, not fields. For any other quantum harmonic oscillators, for any other quantum systems that are not harmonic oscillators, a bit more complicated, this is just not so. And the quantum expectation values have time evolution equations that are different from the classical equations of motion. Of course, they will generally not be totally different. They will be somehow similar to the classical equations of motion, but they will have some modifying terms in them. And the same carries through for quantum field theory, where if you take the original action and then calculate all the quantum effects, you can end up with a so-called quantum effective action, which can be treated just like the classical action, but it has extra terms, and those extra terms tell you why the evolution is a little bit different and how it is different. So you end up with an effective action, which is again depending on the metric and on the meta field. The problem with the effective action is that it's impossible to calculate. It's just too complicated. Perturbatively, you can do it, so you can build it up by orders in the perturbation. So where you assume that the interactions between the fields are very small, and then you do it to first order in the interaction strength, and then to second order, and so on. It involves huge loop integration, a lot of them, and that makes it very difficult to calculate. On top of that, it turns out that those calculations come out infinite. You may have heard of that. But in quantum field theory, when you want to calculate the effective action, you easily run into expressions that are infinite integrals. What exactly that means is not so clear. But what it means for the physics is not so clear. It's generally believed that it indicates a breakdown of the theory at very, very small length scales. In any case, be that as it may, in order to calculate the effective action in quantum field theory, one has to put a cutoff in the length scale. We have to say that we are not integrating our integrals to lengths smaller than a certain cutoff length, which we may call LC, C for cutoff. There are other ways to do it as well, mathematical ways. For example, you perturb the dimension away from 4 a little bit to 4 minus epsilon or 4 plus epsilon. That will do it too, but that's purely a mathematical trick. If you want to do something that makes physical sense, then you have to introduce a cutoff, a so-called ultraviolet cutoff. Assume that there is no length smaller than such and such, or no energy, no momentum higher than such and such. Let us call this smallest length in quantum field theory LC, corresponding to a maximum momentum H bar over LC. Now here comes the key insight of Saharov. He knew all of that. He knew that from the classical action, a quantum effective action in principle can be calculated order by order. And so he knew that there is a chance that once you take your matter fields and their action and you calculate the effective action for them, that maybe some of those effective action terms, so some of those extra terms that come in to form the effective action, some of those extra terms may describe gravity, may be the right terms to give gravity its dynamics. Okay, so he knew that in principle, that's a possibility. We start out just writing down the matter action, and we calculate the quantum perturbations of it, so we calculate how quantum theory is affecting this to get the effective action, which is the old action plus extra terms, and then maybe among those extra terms is what we're looking for, an action for gravity. So Saharov argued now this way. He said that the effective action in all of quantum theory contains all sorts of extra terms, so-called counter terms. All terms. So whatever you could write down as possible extra terms in the action, you have to assume that they will occur. Roughly speaking, this is because, you know, in the path integral picture of quantum theory, every evolution is allowed. Every evolution is allowed and has a probability amplitude. And that should mean that in the action, every term in the action is allowed. Because, you know, the actions, equations of motion tell us what the field evolution is. If every field evolution is allowed, intuitively, it's quite clear that every term in the action could possibly occur. Of course, not completely every term. The terms have to be of the right form. For example, the action always has to be scalar. So all scalar terms, at the very least, could occur. And generally will occur. So therefore, Saharov argued that if you start out with the classical matter action and then calculate the quantum fluctuations around it in order to obtain the effective action will take this form here. The effective action, which is again a functional of the metric and the field, is going to be the original matter action that we wrote down at the beginning, plus quantum effects, the plus terms that are matter action terms, but include quantum effects. So they look just like a matter action. They will have lots of psi fields in them and so on. Plus other terms that may not have psi fields in them. For example, there could be just a constant. There could be a constant times a term which is just the Riemann curvature scalar or the Ricci scalar. Plus, there could be a term that is higher order scalars that you can form with the curvature tensor, and so on. Every scalar that you can form out of the metric tensor, in principle, should occur, and in fact, will occur. It's not an assumption. This is a fact, that all those terms will occur once you calculate the effective action for a classical action, once you go through the so-called renormalization program. So what he said is that there are more scalar terms than just matter action term. Also, this is a scalar, and that is a scalar, and any other thing we can, any other scalar that we can build out of the Riemann curvature tensor, in principle, can occur over here. Oh, I know why the energy, why this thing is losing its patience so quickly. It's because it's running out of energy. Okay. That's what it is. Okay. All right. That should do. All right. Now, this particular term here will turn out to be the vacuum energy or the cosmological constant. This particular term will turn out to be the Einstein action. And those terms over there are assumed to be there in nature, but too small to be observable. You can view the occurrence of those terms as arising in a way that you can visualize from a crystal. Assume you have a crystal. A crystal is made up of harmonic oscillators. All those atoms are harmonically bound to the neighboring atoms. At least in some approximation, they are harmonic. So these are harmonic oscillators, just like a quantum field, consists of lots of harmonic oscillators that are complicated in a, that are coupled in a complicated fashion. Now, what happens if you take the crystal and you shear it or otherwise deform it? Well, then you're deforming those harmonic oscillators. In particular, you're deforming the ground state energies of all those harmonic oscillators. So you are going to affect the overall energy of the crystal when you deform it. Just because you're deforming the harmonic oscillators, you're changing their distances between the atoms and so on. And that changes the zero points of those harmonic oscillators. It changes the whole thing, the coupling strength and everything, if you squeeze or shear that crystal. That means all those harmonic oscillators get different omegas, therefore they get different h bar omega half, different ground state energy. So as you deform a crystal, the overall ground state energy changes. But more than that, there will be also changes in the way that they couple to another, those harmonic oscillators. And that will depend exactly on how you deform those, that crystal. So it will depend on the shape of the deformation. That will also be important for the energy and for the action the same way. And Saro's picture was that this is what's going on with gravity as well. In quantum field theory, on a flat vacuum, you have so much vacuum energy, or you have so much action. And now if you deform that space-time, you're changing those harmonic oscillators in the field. You're changing their ground state energy, and you change how they couple to another. And that change, just the ground state energy on its own, will be just an overall constant. But the way that the energy and the action change as a function of how you complicatedly change the shape of the manifold, that will give you more complicated terms, all adding to the energy, all adding to the action, and so on. So these are terms that express the reaction of the action due to the presence of, of curvature. You see, in a classical theory, you would never see this because everything is just sitting still. The classical fields are just sitting there. Whereas, if a classical field is in its ground state, it's just sitting there. But a quantum field, of course, always has these ground state vacuum fluctuations. And that is why you get those extra terms over there.
And this deforming arises due to the presence of matter.
Yes, ultimately, it's an interplay between the two. I mean, you can view, I mean, the view that Asarov takes here is that the matter fields, through their quantum fluctuations, will induce these two terms and other terms as well, which in turn will determine the action and therefore the equations of motion for gravity. But of course, once you have those terms, you could also say that curvature is affecting the way that matter is moving. So it's an interplay between the two then. But it's not a completely not a completely democratic interplay yet, because we don't really know how to quantize that part yet. Yes. Why it would occur? Yes, you will see that this is the lowest. These are the lowest order scalars that can occur. That's why they are important. In principle, all others are there as well, but those will be the most important one, as we will see in a moment. Okay. So now, remember that there are constants here. There's some coefficient C1, which will depend on exactly how many matter fields we have. And C2 as well, and C3. You know, these are all terms. Each, let's say the electron fields will contribute some C1. Then the up quark will contribute a C1. And then the photons will contribute to C1. All the fields will contribute to all of those coefficients C. And in fact, the fermions will contribute, they have a tendency to contribute with the opposite sign to the boson. But in any case, we can only calculate those coefficients really exactly once we know what the complete matter content is of our world, which we don't. But what we can say about those coefficients C1, C2, et cetera, in front of the gravity terms, in front of the curvature terms, is this. They depend on the details of the matter action. Bosons and fermions tend to contribute with opposite signs. They depend on the order of the perturbation theory. And they depend on the value of the short distance cutoff. Remember that quantum field theories only make sense once you assume that there is some length cutoff. Otherwise, your integrals are infinite. So what we have is that C1 depends on the cutoff. Remember that the cutoff length we call LC. Now, C1 is therefore some constant which has no units times LC to the power of minus 4. Why to the power of minus 4? Well, let's see. This thing I'm claiming is a number times LC to the power of minus 4. And that's because it's LC to the minus 4 because we have four lengths here. See, this is this has units of meter to the fourth power. So therefore, this thing here will have a dependence of the form some number that has to come out from the details of the calculation of the effective action times the cutoff parameter to the power minus 4, simply on the grounds of having to get the units right. C2, however, will be proportional to LC to the power of minus 2. You see, we are following Zaharov's logic here. And that's because this thing already undoes two of those meter to the of those meter units, length units. And that's because the Riemann curvature tensor has units 1 over length squared. Because it has the second derivative of the metric, second spatial derivative. The metric itself has no unit, but the second spatial derivative does. Okay, so well, or the Christoffel symbol, right? It has second derivatives in it. So that gives us 1 over length squared. This is length to the fourth. So the C2 has to provide 1 over length squared, which is to say that C2 is going to be some number that comes out of the calculation of the effective action times LC to the power minus 2. C3 is some number times LC to the power of 0. I think I went too far here. Right. You see, we could have here a term that is like R to the second power, but that already has units of 1 over length to the fourth times length to the fourth is unitless, so therefore C3 is unitless. Some number without a unit times LC to the power 0, and then C4 would have LC to the power of 2, etc. And you see the powers of L will now increase. The more R you use, the more Riemann curvature tensors you use to build your scalar, the higher that power in LC is going to be. And remember that LC is the cutoff length, which is a tiny length. You will later see that it comes out to be 10 to the minus 35 meters. You can imagine that this is a big number, 1 over 10 to the minus 35 to the fourth power. Really big number, right? Because it's a small length, but it's in a denominator. Whereas this thing here is 10 to the minus 35 squared, 10 to the minus 70. It's going to be really small. So you see that the higher order terms are going to be very small, whereas these two are the most important ones. Now, those coefficients here, the lambdas, are going to be unitless numbers that come out from the detailed calculations of the effective action. And we have no reason to assume that those numbers are significantly different from 1. They could be 12, or they could be a third, or anything of the kind. But the theory doesn't provide, in the action, any huge numbers that would account for, let's say, lambda 2 to be a billion. Okay, so I know this is a crude argument, but roughly speaking, those numbers have to be expected to come out of order 1, roughly. So just a sec. And as I said, we expect, just on this dimensional grounds, and because we expect the cutoff length to be really small, we expect C1 to be by far the largest number, C2 to be the next largest, C3, smaller, smaller, smaller. Yep.
What he was asking before, why is it that you're doing this expansion in terms of R? It seems fairly arbitrary.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Okay. So this here is the sum of all the scalars.
Mm-hmm.
All scalars.
Oh, okay. And okay. So you just want some scalar that, it, okay.
Yes. So here I have all scalars. I mean, this is the original action. This is all scalars that involve matter fields. And this is all scalars that don't involve matter fields. And among all scalars that don't involve matter fields, those are the ones that come out biggest. Okay. The others are suppressed by powers of LC. But in principle, since all evolutions are allowed, all terms in the action are allowed, and therefore we have to write down all scalars. So let us look at the lowest order terms now. So the effective action coming from primary field theory looks like this. It's the total effective action of the matter Lagrangian. So it's the original matter Lagrangian plus the effective action terms that take care of Fermat fluctuation. And then we have a term C1, which we will also call minus lambda. And we will also call it the cosmological constant. Lambda we will call the cosmological constant. And we will soon see why that is so. And C2 times R is the Einstein action. So these are the lowest order terms. And we know that they are the ones that contribute most. And now that we have already taken into account the quantum fluctuations of the matter action, namely by dealing with the quantum effective action of the matter, now we set the effective action differentiated with respect to g equal to 0. So we don't take the classical matter action and set its variation with respect to g equal to 0. That would simply tell us that the energy momentum tensor has to be 0. No. We first calculate the full action here, the quantum effective action, and then set its variation with respect to g equal to 0. Which is to say that we set the variation of this thing with respect to the vector equal to 0. As I said, there would be higher order terms in the curvature, but they are going to be very heavily suppressed. And this is, in fact, what Einstein wrote down. He was a bit hesitant about writing down that term, but he definitely wrote down this term. And that's why this is also called the Einstein action. Now, there's some important lesson that we can draw from this as well, which is the following. What we've seen here is that every quantum field theory, and we didn't have to specify any particular one, any quantum field theory which has a minimum length, and it seems unavoidable to have one, otherwise the liberals come out infinite. Every quantum field theory with a minimum length induces Einstein gravity, which is to say that if you calculate its effective action as a function of the cutoff parameter, then you get Einstein gravity. And here is a review by Matt Visser on the subject. And you may wonder, well, but this business with the LC, I mean, how do we know how big LC is? How do we know that? And it turns out that we can fix LC because we know what that coefficient has to be. Because we know that if that coefficient is the right size, then the equations of motion that come out of this will be the Einstein equations of motion. And they have been tested, and they are very precise. you get the correct deflection of the sun light and things like that. The perihelion shift of Mercury, all of those things come out right if C2 is the right value. So what we can do, and we will do that a slide or two further down, is to say, we know what that is by comparison with experiment, or by comparison with Einstein's theory. Therefore, we get an idea about C2, and that will tell us about LC. And we will find out what LC has to be, therefore. But the point I wanted to make is that what we see here is that we didn't have to specify the particular quantum field theory. We were able to operate on the grounds of some very, very, very general argument, simply saying that quantum field theories produce all terms, all scalars. And then we said that the lowest, the scalars in terms of the curvature and not in terms of the fields that are dominant are the two ones up there, the cosmological constant and the Ricci scalar. And so, therefore, automatically, any quantum field theory will produce gravity. This, I think, is very important for the following reason. There are a lot of models out there for quantum gravity. And it's clear that any one of those has to reduce to quantum field theory at sufficiently low energy. At sufficiently large length scales, it has to reduce to quantum field theory because the quantum field theory is a very successful theory. But then by extension, it means that any one of those theories automatically reduces to gravity as well. Okay? So this means the following. For example, if, let's say you come up with a new theory of quantum gravity. Let's call it string theory. Okay? And then you go through a lot of calculations, and at the end of the day, you find out that you get, in a limiting case, you get the gravity action out of it. Then you can do one of two things. You can say you have a wonderful theory because you've derived gravity, the right gravity action. Or you can say it's no wonder. Because if your theory produces quantum field theory at low energy, then it's bound to produce the gravity action as well. So I think it's not a strong point. If you come up with your own theory of quantum gravity, and after lengthy calculations find out that it induces gravity, it induces the gravity action, then keep in mind that it had to. If it's a good theory, it has to reduce to quantum field theory, but quantum field theory on curved space induces the gravity action automatically. I think that's the main message of Sakharov, and we should really keep always that fact in mind. Yep?
Is the variation in terms with respect to the matter from zero as well for this?
Yes, we will. We can do the variation with respect to the matter field as well, and then we get the equations of motion for the matter that already includes the quantum effect. And if we do the variation with respect to the metric, then we get the Einstein equation.
What so far nobody has really achieved is to actually do the calculate the quantum effective action for the quantum theory of matter of the metric. That is the hard part. So in principle, you would want to do a path in the kernel. I mean, you would sum over all possible space-time shapes, over all metrics. But that proves to be very hard. Because the metric is not at all like the other fields. You know, and for example, the other fields, just a sec, I'll be there in a moment. The other fields, for example, could vanish. Okay, the metric could not vanish anywhere. It's a totally different animal. Because it, and, you know, and also, there's always a coordinate system in which it is just minus 1, 1, 1, 1. So maybe you want to quantize the Christoffel symbols then, but they are not tensors. And then you have the problem that you may be overcounting things dramatically because there are many different ways to describe the same manifold. Same differential manifold and can be given by many different charts with different looking metrics, but they're still the same manifold. So how do you avoid the overcounting? It's very difficult to find out whether two Sudo-Riemannian manifolds that you may be given in different ways are or are not the same. It's hard to identify that. So the gravitational effective action is extremely hard to calculate. Yes.
Are you also working for electromagnetism? Like could you use it to derive Maxwell's equations in the same way?
What do you mean by this argument?
Using an effective action.
with the quantum
field? Well, yes. Remember that electromagnetism has an action. It's the F-menu thing. Right? And then you can ask, well, will I get extra terms? And you will. If you calculate the effective action for electromagnetism, there will be extra terms. And if you calculate the effective action for electromagnetism on curved space, there will be extra terms, including terms containing the curvature. Electromagnetism too will induce gravity.
So why are the cross terms, that means terms in one
field? There are, but I bunched them together with the meta points. But in principle, there are, that's right. Yeah, you have to look at the units and verify that they're not going to be double. You know, with the same consideration with the LC, and you have to check what units does the field psi have that the R comes multiplied with, and so on.
We take in the action all possible terms, and then we neglect depending on the strengths.
Yes, that's right. So we start with the matter action, then we add to that all possible scalars, and we consider only the dominant ones, the dominant two ones. So the dominant two terms are these. Remember, this was the cosmological constant term, just the constant, and then another term, which was the Ricci scalar, which is when you write it out, R minu times T minu. So our task now is to find out what is the equation of motion for gravity, assuming this. So this is the full effective action. We consider only the two dominant terms here. We do now the functional differentiation of the effective action with respect to the metric, set this equal to zero, and this we expect to be our Wenzel equation, our equation of motion for gravity. We know what one of these, there's going to be several terms that come out of this functional differentiation. One term is going to be the functional derivative of this term, just the matter effective action with respect to the matrix. Okay? That's just going to be the energy momentum tensor. But not the energy momentum tensor of just the classical fields, it's the energy momentum tensor for the full quantum effective action. And then there are going to be extra terms, because we're going to have to differentiate the effective action with respect to this, on C1, we will have to differentiate with respect to the metric. Sounds trivial because it's a constant, but it's not, because it's multiplied with the square root of g. And so we pick up a functional derivative in this. And then we have to differentiate r times square root of g also with respect to g. So we get three terms when we calculate that. And one of them is going to be the energy momentum tensor, and the two others give us the Einstein tensor, as it will turn out. Okay, so how do we calculate that? We have to calculate the functional derivative of the effective action with respect to g. This is the effective action. And so what we obtain is, as I said, one term is going to give us just the energy momentum tensor. And then we still have to do the functional derivative of those two other terms. So this is going to be the Einstein equation, the equation of motion for gravity. We have to evaluate the left-hand side. So we have to evaluate, in particular, this term here. And then we evaluate the functional derivative of that term as well. So we have to calculate the variation of C1 times square root of g. We already did the variation of square root of g with respect to g, because that piece comes also up in the calculation of the angular momentum tensor. Namely, we know that the derivative of square root of g with respect to g is this. If you put it in here, we arrive at that expression, which is proportional to the variation of g mu nu. Now the second term, we have to functionally differentiate also this term here, the Ricci scalar. You know, the Riemann curvature tensor contracted until it just becomes a scalar. I could have written just R here, but I wrote it out what it really is, R mu nu times g mu nu, so that we see that we have two terms when you functionally differentiate that. We have to functionally differentiate the R, and we have to functionally differentiate the G, and work with the Leibniz rule. Okay, so we get two terms. The variation of R times leaving this invariant, plus leaving the first piece invariant and functionally differentiating that piece over here. First claim is that the first term here is vanishing. It's not going to contribute.
To see this, let us look at an arbitrary point of the manifold and choose a geodesic coordinate system around that point. Then we know that the Ricci scalar, which is ordinarily this expression here, reduces to just the first two terms because the Christoffel symbols, remember, vanish at the origin of a geodesic coordinate system. So therefore, the variation of the Ricci tensor is given by this expression here. And therefore, you know, we have to contract this. Remember that what really occurs in here is the contraction of this term with the G mu nu. So if we calculate that now, the contraction of the variation of R with G mu nu, we get G mu nu contracted with those two Christoffel symbols over there. And this now has the form of some contravariant tensor, comma alpha. Just check out what the indices are doing, you find that this is so. But remember also that the G mu nu comma alpha is equal to zero. At the origin of a geodesic coordinate system, the metric is just the usual special relativity metric. It takes that form as a matrix. And also its derivative is vanishing at that point. Now we can lift this back. If this equation holds, we can lift this back to an arbitrary coordinate system where it has to hold with a semicolon now, because it has to be a covariant derivative. So we find that this combination here, G mu nu times the variation of the Ricci tensor, is that sort of term. And I'm saying that sort of term because, remember, we discussed that sort of term at the beginning of the class today. That's going to give us a divergence. So the term in question here, when integrated over a bulk spacetime, B, will give us a divergence. But the divergence, remember, is exterior derivative or co-boundary operator times, but after the inner derivative. And the exterior derivative can be traded for going from the bulk integral to a surface integral. So the co-boundary operator becomes a boundary operator. And then we say that this is equal to zero. I am actually cutting short a discussion that should be longer. We are saying here that at the boundary, we let the variation of the metric drop to zero. But really, there is a non-trivial issue there, especially when you do the quantum field theory. But I would like to refer you to the literature on to exactly why and when that boundary term can be set to zero. Basically, there are circumstances in which you want to keep that boundary term and which becomes important. Roughly speaking, whenever you want to calculate the evolution in a sort of Hamiltonian picture, where you start giving initial conditions, and then you want to evolve the scenario further through a final time, then your boundary delta B of your space-time region is going to contain, in particular, the initial time surface and the final time surface. And it's going to be rather non-trivial to have, you know, initial surface, final surface, and you will have to actually keep track of the terms that you get at those points. You can't just say everything's trivial there, because you want to give non-trivial initial conditions there. So you want to keep those boundary terms. It's just one of those issues that arises in general relativity where things are a little bit more complicated than one might expect. Now let's evaluate the second term here. So we leave this invariant and we do the variation of G mu nu square root of G. The variation of that, I think we did already. Remember one thing, by Leibniz rule, we get two terms. Remember that the variation of the G mu nu with the upper indices is minus the variation of the G mu nu with the lower indices and then multiplied with those. Remember how we derived that? We showed that we started with the observation that, you know, G mu nu, G mu alpha is delta mu alpha, right? And then if you do the variation of this, it's certainly zero, because the variation of that is zero. This is stratigraphic at delta. It's just one or zero. And therefore, you have that the by the Leibniz rule now, you relate the variation of the lower index g to the variation of the upper index g, and you pick up a minus sign between the two. All right, this is what we use here. We go from here to there. And then at the end of the day, we obtain that if you put it all together, we get that the variation of that whole term, I mean, the variation of this vanished, the variation of this piece then gives us those two terms here. Because we have those two terms, and they have to be contracted with the R mu nu. So we get this R term and that R term, the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar, simply coming from contracting those guys with the R mu nu over here. We can now bring it all together. And we find that the variation of these terms, that the lowest order terms, the most important terms in the effective action, is this expression here. Now, keep in mind that, remember that when we calculated the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric tensor, we obtained the energy momentum tensor. For the energy momentum tensor, we had a choice. We could have made it anti-symmetric. We could have given it an anti-symmetric component, but it wouldn't have mattered. So we dropped it out because it's going to be projected out anyway. Here, very similarly now, we obtain this expression here, and the G mu nu is symmetric tensor, so that is going to be symmetric, and therefore also that better be symmetric. In principle, in order to calculate that derivation, we could have added some anti-symmetric piece, but it would have dropped out because we would have anti-symmetric tensor times symmetric tensor, and that gives us just a zero. So I'm keep mentioning little details like this where one could have done something else differently, because we know that even though we are pretty confident we understand general relativity and quantum field theory, there's certainly something we don't understand. Because otherwise, we could have quantized the whole thing, right? So I'm just highlighting a little things, some of which may not turn out to be what they should be at the end of the day. This one is pretty safe, though. Okay. So we obtain, therefore, that the functional derivative of those two terms, putting everything together that we found, is C1 times 1 half g mu nu minus this, where the g mu nu, remember, is the Einstein tensor. Remember that this piece here that we calculated in the just a minute ago, this piece here, that combination is what we call the Einstein tensor. Do you remember that? Remember what we showed about the Einstein tensor? We showed that when you do its covariant derivative with respect to B and contract over the B, you get a Bianchi identity. Anyway, so all right. So what we obtain is that the functional derivative of this cosmological constant plus the Ricci scalar gives us this expression here, the Einstein tensor up to a coefficient, and then this tensor, this thing times the cosmological constant. So finally, we conclude that our equation of motion for gravity is this. Okay? That comes from the functional differentiation with respect to the matter. This is the energy momentum tensor. This is the functional differentiation of the first two terms in the effective action. I mean, the first two new terms in the effective action, which we can also write in this form here. Okay? I just divided everything through some constant. This is how we can write the equations of motion of gravity now. As I said, we can compare with experiment. We know that we get the right answer for all the tests of general relativity that have been performed so far if we neglect this term, and I'll discuss it in a moment, and this constant C2 is chosen to be 1 over 16 pi d. Because this equal to 16 pi g p mu nu is the Einstein equation. So the C2, remember, we couldn't derive. It comes out from quantum field theory in principle, but we don't know what all of the fields are. And even if we knew, we wouldn't be able to calculate the effective action to all orders in the perturbation theory. But we know from experiment that it has to come out this way. Because we know how the energy momentum are coupling to space-time. We know how much curvature they produce. We can measure that. So C2 is this particular value, nothing else. Therefore, we obtain the Einstein equation in this form. Where we also have this cosmological constant. And remember, it comes with a C1. We expect this to be a bigger term than this thing, which was the C2. Now, we know C2. We just figured out what C2 is. But from C2, we get an idea of what LC, the cutoff length, ought to be, up to numbers of order 1, right? But once we have the cutoff length, we are able to calculate what C1 ought to be up to numbers of order 1. Let's do this. And in this way, we will be very unsuccessful, actually. We will get the worst prediction ever. What is lambda? Well, we have to find out LC. Remember that we know that C2 is this. But C2 is also lambda 2 times LC squared, lambda 2 being of order 1. Okay? It could be like 5 or half or something like this, but it's not going to be a billion. So this is of order 1. So C2 is LC to the power minus 2, which is to say that LC is given by that. Okay? This particular combination, I just reinstated h bar and the speed of light so that you can do it yourself in ordinary SI units. And we find that LC has to be a number of order 1 times 4 square root of pi times this particular combination here, which comes out to be 1.6 times 10 to the minus 35 meters, the famous Planck length, which we can rephrase now to say that if we cut off quantum field theory calculations at the Planck length, then quantum field theory will induce for us the Einstein action with the correct term in front of it. This will come out to be 8 pi g if quantum field theory is cut off at the Planck length. Okay? This is the main reason why people think that quantum field theory should be cut off at the Planck length. Nobody says it's got to be exactly the Planck length because we have this fudge factor here. But it ought to be that order of magnitude. Okay, so now we know what LC should be. But remember that C1 is a number of order 1 times LC to the power minus 4. So therefore, this is just saying again that if we cut off quantum field theory at the Planck length, then we get gravity with the right strength. Now, find C1. You know that LC is 10 to the minus 35 meters, roughly. And C1 is a number of order 1. Sorry, that arrow should point up there instead. This one, lambda 1, is of order 1. Okay, and we know how big this is. This is of order 1. Let us set this equal to 1 just to get an idea. And this one, we know how big it is. So finally, we obtain the predicted value for lambda from quantum field theory. And what do we get? Well, we obtain that it's about 10 to the 70 in SI units. It's about 10 to the 70 per meter squared. That's our prediction for the cosmological constant, which already looks like a big number, right? Now let's see how big it really is. It's the worst prediction ever, of course, you all know about this, but how bad is it? Let's see, based on cosmic microwave background data and on supernova data that plot the brightness versus redshift data, which really provide a relatively solid evidence for the existence of a cosmological constant at all, it seems that experimentally the cosmological constant is about 10 to the minus 52. So instead of, you know, instead of plus 70, it's minus 52, which would be bad enough if it weren't raised, you know, 10 to the power of. This is 10 to the power. So we are off by 122 orders of magnitude. This is really very far off. So the status of that story is that we don't know. Apparently, the constant part of the effective action, C1, the cosmological constant, for some reason, does not seem to be curving space. It is somehow exempt from that business. Because if it were, space could never be as big as it is. Space-time would have to be very small. Or, I mean, we don't know even what the sign of it is, right? I mean, the 10 to the, this year, 10 to the 70, right? Could be positive or negative. We don't know, because bosons will contribute to one direction, fermions in the other direction, could come out anything. So we don't know what's happening there. We know that the next term, the C2 term, is giving us Einstein, the Einstein action, which is, of course, just fine. It's just exactly what we need. But the first term is somehow absent or shielded from doing its gravity part. And it could be repulsive or contractive, depending on the sign of this. Now, as I said, contributing to the theoretical value there are bosons and fermions, and they could contribute with opposite signs. Now, if in the world we had exact supersymmetry and space were not curved, then that would actually come out zero, which also wouldn't be so good because it would still be off by 52 orders of magnitude. But for a while, up until about 10 years ago, it was assumed that the experimental value is zero. And then it was a viable idea to think that supersymmetry might just press this to zero too, and then you would have theory and experiment both predicting zero. But now we are really in trouble here because we know that the experimental value is non-zero but finite. And we know that it's really minus 52 and not minus 53 or minus 51. So we know that it's of that order of magnitude. And on the other hand, it's very hard to see why bosons and fermions would conspire to give a value as small as this without having a symmetry that forces them to conspire. Supersymmetry could force them to conspire such that for every bosonic contribution, there's a fermionic contribution, the whole thing adds up to zero. But, well, for one thing, we don't have supersymmetry in nature, at least we haven't seen it yet, meaning that if there is one, it has to be broken, probably relatively strongly broken. And secondly, we don't know of any other symmetry principle, but maybe one of you will find one day, that would force bosonic and fermionic contributions to conspire to give us a number as small as that. That's the cosmological constant problem. All right, we are way over time today. But you had a lot of questions too. All right.